Civic Media News, I'm Derek Tritz. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. The American Red Cross in Wisconsin is pleading for volunteers willing to help the Hurricane Helene relief. 30 volunteers with the American Red Cross of Wisconsin have answered the call in recent days. Volunteers will get training. They'll have to commit to 2 weeks of service. Anyone who's interested can sign up at redcross.org/volunteer. Democrat Kamala Harris at the birthplace of the Republican Party Thursday, picking up the endorsement of former GOP Congresswoman Liz Cheney.
She possesses some of the qualities of character that I most respect in any individual and any leader. Courage, especially at a moment like this.
Cheney says she's never voted for a Democrat for president, but she says now is a time to put country before party. Cheney has called Donald Trump a threat to democracy. And that's what you need to know. I'm Derek Tritz, and this is Civic Media News.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Donald Trump just can't let it go, cannot take the fact that he lost in 2020, cannot accept that the majority of Americans sent him packing, still on the I won bandwagon. In fact, was doing Dr. Phil's show, who, of course, Dr. Phil seems a little to have taken the crazy turn, like the Musk. You got Trump coming out saying that he won California. If I got the right count, he said, quote, and I love the calling out to the higher angels. He said, if Jesus Christ came down and was the vote counter, I would win California. Evidently, according to him, he does great with Hispanics, better than any Republican's ever done. But you have to have an honest vote counter because he would win. He said, I see it. I go around California. They have Trump signs all over the place. It's a very dishonest state, he said. Everything is mail-in. They send out 38 million ballots. I think it is. No, that's the population, ding-dong. And I love how he does this. Whatever it is, I'm going to throw out this huge number so that it makes it sound like there's some nefarious plot going on. And then the minions all run with it. 17 million people voted in California, 70% of the eligible population. Those are the numbers. Mail-in ballots, part of it. This idea that it's all fraudulent is going to be interesting to play out this election cycle as they're trying to get their voters to vote by mail. It's crazy. Crazy. Now, you want to talk about some eye-popping numbers. You want to talk about some crazy numbers. The AFL-CIO has come out with their CEO Paywatch, and they point out that in 2013, the pay of our heavy 500, the S&P 500 companies, they got a nice little bump, 6% raise over the year, up to now an average of $17.7 million. That's pretty good if you can get it, I guess. Now that is what they point out is a 268-1 ratio for workers to CEO. It takes 268 workers, their salaries, to make just one CEO. How about we get rid of the CEO and we hire 268 people to do the job so that maybe we get some freaking customer service. I don't know if you've noticed, but you can't talk to anyone anywhere ever with these big companies. It's all AI now, and it's going to get worse. Because it's all about squeezing the quarter till the eagle screams. As the AFL-CIO points out, it would take 5 career lifetimes. More than that. maybe six, for one of us to earn what a CEO makes. So you think about, you know, your lifespan's what, 40, 50 years of working? Only five, maybe six of those lifespans, 1 year of CEO pay, something wrong there. Now understand, you know, we're saddled with the inflation that the right keeps screaming about. And they keep saying, well, it's those workers' wages that are causing the grocery prices to go up. Commodity prices in this country fell by 3%. Consumer prices rose by 3%. CEO pay went up by 6%. Corporate profits, you want to guess? Or should I just say 11%? So there's, when you look at the balance sheet on the teeter-totter of the economy, it seems heavily weighted toward the corporate profits and the CEO. Seems like someone's lining their pocket at the expense of the rest of us. And surprise, we've known that for a very long time. You go back to that tax cut thing that Trump, you go back to every tax cut that Republican politicians have rammed down our throats. It's all been, here's a little something for you. And oh, by the way, we're going to take the rest of it. We have, in this country, created a billionaire class, second to none in history. We have given corporations a pass, for the most part, on paying their share of our tax burden. And as I said yesterday, taxes are the price of admission to living in this country. Taxes are the price of admission to being able to take advantage of all of the things that we've built, the infrastructure, the education, the healthcare, the military, the legal system, all of this stuff. And the people who exercise that, the rights to those things, I don't know, the very wealthy who use all of those things more than the rest of us, of what much is given, much is expected. So for me, this idea that we're going to cut taxes on corporations, we're going to cut taxes on the very wealthy, we're going to put so many loopholes in place that they never pay anything. But oh, by the way, any tax break that you got during the Trump years is going to sunset in 2025. I don't know. I think the message there is you working people don't matter. Clearly, I mean, that's what I take from it. When you look at the big corporations and you look at the CEOs and you look at the very wealthy, especially how they get their income, it's quite remarkable that we haven't come out with the pitchforks. And this is where during the Tea Party years, I was on board at the beginning. I got the tea thing, taxed enough already. Working people are taxed, and not just taxed, feed to death. I was talking to my producer today about, you know, his kids taking driver's ed. When I was in school, driver's ed was like a class. You didn't have to dig into your, mom and dad didn't dig into the pocket to put out a couple hundred bucks for you to take driver's ed. It was part of the curriculum. Now, no. You want your kid to play in a band? You got to come up with money. You want your kid to do extracurriculars? Now it's bake sales or dig into your pocket or sell sandwiches at work. How did we get here? You talk to college kids who are going to get, thanks to our Supreme Court, getting screwed over to get some debt relief. Taxpayers used to pay that stuff. And what we did is we said, no, we value rich people over an educated populace, rich people over a debt-free populace. They're smart. They know what to do with the money. And I agree, rich people are smart. They do know what to do with the money. It has nothing to do with us. Doesn't make my life better to know that Jeff Bezos has got a gazillion dollars. Doesn't do me any good knowing that Warren Buffett and the rest of them are never going to worry about missing a meal. Because it doesn't, it never trickles down. But Rick, they create jobs. No, they were going to create those jobs regardless if you gave them massive tax breaks. Because what they understand is by creating opportunities to make more money, they sometimes have to employ people. And this idea that there's a benevolency to tax cuts is just mind-numbingly ludicrous. And thank you to all the people who sent emails making that clear to me that we're finally getting it. And that maybe Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are on the right track. Maybe we need to start talking about in a much more aggressive way. A government that is an activist government that is looking to do good things, making lives better, and getting, well, the people with all the money who have been given enormous sums of wealth, maybe we go and get some of it from them. Just seems sane, seems logical to me. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. When we come back, Jordan Barab is going to be here to share some thoughts on work environment and, well, just how dangerous work can be. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday, we were talking about heat-related deaths and had a reporter on talking about the story down in Texas of a UPS driver who, because of the heat, died on the job. And I said, look, you know, the reality is we're as climate's changed, this is going to be more and more. The email box full of people saying, hey, I've had these experiences, and backing me up with this idea that, you know, personal responsibility only goes so far when you've got an employer towering over you and no protections of a union to defend yourself. So for me, there's a lot here, and where our federal government, state and local governments really need to ramp it up and protect workers in the workplace. And that's why I've asked our good friend Jordan Barab to come share some thoughts. Jordan was a former acting assistant secretary and deputy assistant secretary of labor for OSHA during the Obama years, runs the confined space, website that, understand, follows people being hurt and injured and killed on the job. You can find that at jordanbarab.com/confined space. Jordan, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be here again, Rick.
So, like I said, yesterday we're talking about this and my email box full of stories of people going, hey, you know, this happened to me. This situation came up. Management was, you know, bearing down. There's all of this stuff. There needs to be a law. It reminds me of the Schoolhouse Rock thing. There ought to be a law. Why hasn't this happened yet?
Well, for heat, I mean, we need a heat standard. There's no doubt about that. The National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health recommended that OSHA issue a heat standard in 1972. And certainly heat hazards, we've known about them for decades, if not centuries. So it's nothing new. It's been hard to do because it's a big standard. And I know when we were there, we wanted to do one, but we were just too busy with other things that we were trying to get out at the time. Finally, the Biden administration did start working on one. But even though they've made some great progress, it won't be out for a couple of years, at least. Happily, we have some states that are doing the right thing. I mean, California has had for a long time an outdoor heat standard, and they just issued an indoor heat standard. Oregon and Washington both have indoor and outdoor heat standards. Maryland's working on one, which is good because a Baltimore Public Works sanitation worker just died a few weeks ago from heat while he was picking up garbage on a 100-degree day in the city. We've just seen just today I was looking over my list of people killed in the workplace. There was a fire department recruit in Arizona that died of heat. Couple of weeks ago, there was a UPS worker, you know, driving in an air-conditioned truck, died of heat stroke. Interestingly, I mean, these are the people that die. So you actually have a little bit of data on these, although I think we miss a lot of the deaths as well, because some of the symptoms are similar to a heart attack or a stroke, and they may not be designated as heat related. A couple of weeks ago, we had, I think it was a UPS driver, passed out because of the heat, ran in, you know, the truck went into the opposite lane, luckily didn't hit anybody, and hit a tree. He was injured. But I mean, what that does is that's an indication that The toll of heat is not just in, you know, people that are dying or even people that go to the hospital. There are people that, you know, just have accidents because they can't pay attention. They can't concentrate when they're being affected by heat.
No, no. Look, I remember, you know, playing football, doing doubles in August. And having that, you know, those heat related moments where you're a little disoriented, and you know, look, you were young, you didn't think anything of it. Now that I'm in my 50s, I think a lot differently than I did back then. And doing physical manual labor in the you know, July, August heat, something now I think a lot differently about. But fortunately, as a card carrying teamster, I do have the sense of empowerment that if I'm not feeling well, I'm going to go find some air conditioning, some water, some something to make sure that I go home at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're aware of it, you know, if you're aware of the hazards and you know, the symptoms. I mean, you know, this Baltimore case was particularly sad because the worker had been having symptoms all day long, hadn't been feeling well, but nobody had been trained about the symptoms of heat or what to do about it. So he literally was about to pass out, and he knocked on someone's door asking them for water, and then he passed out. Unfortunately, his coworkers didn't really know what to do, so they called the office instead of calling 911. And that's going to be an important part of the heat standard when OSHA issues it, is training for supervisors employees and you know, and an emergency response plan, so that when someone is affected by heat, you know, they get help as soon as they can, because you know, it can kill you pretty fast.
Yeah. No, we talked yesterday about this idea of personal responsibility, because this was the UPS default. You know, it's the individual's responsibility to drink the water and do all this stuff. And look, you know, given the fact that there aren't a lot of easy places to park those trucks and all of that, that only goes so far. Conditions matter. But how much of this personal responsibility argument do you think is where we should be focusing our attention?
Well, that seems to be where management's focusing its attention. You know, if workers can't be responsible enough to drink when they need to drink, then, you know, they get what's coming to them. That's kind of been the argument from some management groups opposing an OSHA standard. You know, you could say that for a lot of hazards in the workplace. You know, if workers can't be careful enough to use this power saw, you know, it serves them right to get their fingers cut off. If you can't pay attention to where you're walking on top of a roof and you fall off, you know, well, that's your fault. I mean, this is an antiquated theory of workplace safety and health, that it's the workers' fault. And it leads into a kind of a very popular among some management groups theory, which is called behavioral safety, which is basically the theory that if you just convince people to be more careful and punish them when they're not careful, so punish them when they get hurt, you know, then everything will be fine. But that is totally opposite to what the Occupational Safety and Health Act says. The Occupational Safety and Health Act says in no uncertain terms that it is the employer's responsibility to establish a safe workplace, period, end. So, you know, it's not a matter of, you know, workers being, you know, lazy or careless or, you know, irresponsible. It is the employer's responsibility to establish a safe workplace. And if you have machine guards, you don't have to worry about, you know, your fingers getting cut off if you have a moment of, you know, inattention or falling off a roof because you slip on something, you know, because you've got fall protection. And the same thing with heat. I mean, if you've got the water there and you've got the right to stop and go to a shaded area or a cool area, you know, every hour or two, you know, then you don't have to worry about this personal responsibility, because that's part of the job. Part of the job is the employer providing the safe conditions in the workplace so that workers don't get hurt or sick.
Yeah, no, but you know, again, that's gonna dig into the productivity and ultimately the profit. But your argument, you know, this argument about personal responsibility, and it's your fault because you knew the risks. This goes back to the pre-workers' comp days.
Exactly.
This is an old argument. This is not new.
Yeah, no, risk assumption. Yeah, you knew it was a dangerous job, so you know, you bought into that. That's why we're paying you the big bucks. You know, so that's the risk you just assume when you take the job. And again, that was, I mean, it never was a very good theory, and workers' comp dealt with that to a certain extent, but it was really the Occupational Safety and Health Act, which wasn't, you know, passed till 1970, I mean, fairly late in this nation's history, that actually, you know, finally gave the employer the responsibility to provide a safe workplace.
You know, what's amazing is that, you know, a lot of the response we got yesterday was, you know, people going, hey, how come these UPS trucks don't have air conditioning? Everybody's got air conditioning. How is it that these vehicles don't? And look, and pushed it back on the Teamsters for not doing it sooner to get air conditioning into these vehicles. Any thoughts in that world?
Well, you know, things have gotten worse. I mean, again, heat's always, we've always known that heat is a problem, but there's no doubt that things have gotten much, much worse over the last decade with climate change. And the awareness has gone up as well. And so, you know, it's not a matter of now of saying, well, you know, gosh, I didn't really know what the symptoms were. I really didn't know what to do. No one has that excuse anymore that they don't know what's going on. And none of the regulatory agencies also have the excuse anymore that they don't have time to do it. This has become, you know, everyone's top priority now to protect workers against heat.
Has it? Is it everyone's top priority? Because I got to tell you, I'm looking at Florida. I'm looking at Texas. Two states where local municipalities said, hey, we want to have something of a heat standard. We can argue whether they were good or they're bad, too much, too little, whatever. But then you had the state come in with their preemption laws, Texas literally calling theirs the Death Star bill.
Yeah, yeah.
And overturning this stuff and, you know, making heat related deaths great again.
Yeah, I misspoke when I said everyone. I mean, every responsible person. No, you have, you know, Governor DeSantis and Governor Abbott who are going the exact opposite direction by forbidding, you know, localities from passing ordinances that would protect workers. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, you know, why, you know, when we see this, you know, significant rise in heat-related illness and heat-related deaths in the workplace, you see a situation where OSHA isn't going to get a federal standard out for at least 2 years and possibly longer if Trump's elected. You know, to have these states forbidding localities from taking the responsibility to protect their employees is just outrageous.
Now, I read a story, you know, in preparing for the interview yesterday, that said the UPS worker who died, OSHA issued a fine of $66,000. And it just seems to me, I don't know. It doesn't seem like the punishment. It doesn't seem like the repercussion fits, you know, whatever the situation is, because it seems like life is fairly cheap.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and you know, OSHA penalties, I mean, first of all, they'll never be high enough to you know, pay for somebody's death, for pay for somebody losing their husband or their son or, you know, child. That's just not the way, you know, the law unfortunately works these days, even when there's a fairly significant penalty. But yeah, I mean, that we do need higher penalties. We need more publicity about things like that. And OSHA needs to, you know, be, I mean, unfortunately, they need to be more places. You know, they can't be everywhere. In fact, they're so understaffed that, you know, the AFL estimates that OSHA, you know, if every workplace in the United States were to be inspected just once, it would take 195 years. So obviously OSHA can't be everywhere.
And it's getting worse is what you're saying, because I thought it was 177. Now it's up over 190.
It gets worse every year because basically OSHA hasn't had a significant budget increase since 2010. So with inflation and everything, basically OSHA is getting a cut every year.
So what you're telling me is even if OSHA comes out with a heat standard, enforcing it is going to be extraordinarily difficult because you don't have cops on the beat.
Yeah, enforcing health and safety standards is always difficult. Happily, you know, most employers will look at the standards. They want to follow the law and they'll do what they're supposed to do. But you still have a significant number of outliers who, you know, won't do that.
And this is where, you know, I come back with the idea that, you know, we need much stronger unions. You know, because as I said a moment ago, as a card carrying Teamster, I feel empowered to take care of myself. I've said before, I've never taken an unsafe truck out on the road knowingly. If the brakes are on adjustment, if there's some lights out, if there's things hanging off of it, that's going to get fixed before I move it out onto the road. And the same thing with myself. If there's something that I'm not feeling well, there's something that I feel that I'm overheating, I take a break.
Yeah, and you have the advantage, again, as you say, of having a union, and having a union, I guess, with some pretty strong contract language that allows you to, you know, to basically refuse dangerous work. You know, most workers obviously don't even have a union, and even those that do, many of those that do, don't have strong enough contract language, or they just don't know. They haven't been trained about the hazards that they have to deal with. They don't even know if they're working in a dangerous situation.
Now, I got to tell you, I get the training part of it, but there's a part internally you go, yeah, this doesn't feel right. When your gut's saying, I don't know, this doesn't feel right, maybe listen.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and you don't have to, I mean, you can call for an OSHA inspection without knowing, you know, there's a violation there. If you just have a good faith belief there's a violation. And the same thing, you know, OSHA has, they don't quite have a rule, but basically they have an interpretation of a rule that says, you know, workers with a good faith belief that the job is unsafe have a right to refuse that work. Now, you know, whether that'll be upheld or not, you know, it's kind of risky in any case, but obviously it's better than dying.
No, absolutely. And this, again, I keep coming back to that U word that is so important to me, and I think should be important to every working person. The idea of having that union backing, that contract, that grievance procedure, someone in your corner when you have to make those decisions, so vitally important. I want to come back to the heat standard real quick because, we released something back in July, as I understand.
Yeah, well, back in July, the heat proposal was announced. So this is the proposal that will then allow for comments and eventually hearings. It wasn't published. Well, it actually still hasn't been published in the Federal Register. From what I hear, it'll be published tomorrow in the Federal Register. So at that point, I think it's a 120-day comment period, which is fairly long, will start. And that would be followed by hearings. But obviously, this will go over the election and even over Inauguration Day. So if there's a Trump administration, that will all probably grind to a halt.
And that's where I was going with this, because again, it seems to me that one party cares for workers, one party, I let the evidence speak for itself, because there was nothing done during the Trump years to protect workers in the workplace. Biden has been trying, they're moving, this is, as you pointed out, a very long process. And come November, we make the wrong choice at the ballot box, this goes away.
Yep, exactly. As does a lot of enforcement and budget and everything else. I mean, you look at the Republican budget in the House, for OSHA. I mean, that calls for a major cut. Project 2025 has this weird line about the Labor Department budgets. They should be reduced to a historical average. Now, I'm not sure exactly what that means. Does that mean you average OSHA's budget since 1970 till today, and that's what the budget's going to be? I don't know.
You average it from 1776 when it didn't exist.
I mean, if somebody told me when I was working, that I had to, my next salary was going to be an average of every salary I'd made since I was, 22, wouldn't have been good.
No, it would not be good because I'd be very poor. you're spot on. So this comment period, where can we go? What should we do? Because I think stories like a lot of the ones that I got of, people working in the heat and, up in a trailer, loading boxes and, falling because they almost passed out. These are stories people should, I don't know, maybe document in this.
Yeah, absolutely. And right now they'll start tomorrow, the written process period, and you can get on that website. There's a separate website for written comments, which you'll be able to find through the OSHA website. And absolutely, OSHA needs, everybody's story there. And then there's gonna be, assuming there's a Democratic administration, there will be hearings. And OSHA, OSHA hearings, administrative hearings for standards are fascinating because anybody can come and testify. And they often go on for weeks, sometimes in different parts of the country if they have enough money. So you find a lot of workers coming to testify at those and telling their stories and why they need a standard and why, watching their coworkers get sick and die. And the fun part about OSHA hearings, if you're so inclined, is that not only can you testify, but if you're a witness at an OSHA hearing, you can also ask any of the other witnesses questions. So, if you're a worker and you testify and then an industry person gets up there and says, oh no, it should be personal responsibility, you can actually get up there and question that employer, or you can question OSHA about why they're doing something and why they're not. It's the only agency that actually allows witnesses to also question other witnesses.
Wow, this is one of those, because I got a question, how much would it cost for you to come stand in my driveway in January or in February when it's, five below zero and the wind's blowing how long just to stand there? You don't have to do any work, just stand there, how much?
Yeah. Right. So it's a process. It's a useful process in terms of OSHA getting the kind of information it needs. Unfortunately, it's also a long process, so it takes a while.
Well, it's one we should be all working people most certainly should be involved in. But Jordan, yep, I appreciate you taking some time, sharing your expertise. Okay. As always, great stuff.
Okay, good to be here, Wirt.
Our good friend Jordan Barab. Make sure to check out his website, jordanbarab.com/confinedspace. I want to hear your story. You got a work story where something bad almost happened, or someone else you saw it happen to? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Want to hear it. Back after this.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got a bone to pick with my next guest because we were both in Chicago for the DNC and someone didn't come to visit me, but he's got an incredible article in his latest newsletter out that's saying, hey, you know, there are people who are begging our media to rise to the occasion of 2024. But as he points out, they're hitting new lows. And he writes, and this is the part that I find interesting. He says, this column about the decline and fall of America's political news media in such a pivotal election has proved very hard to write, not for a lack of material, but because I can't keep pace with every day's new and stunning examples of bad journalism, each one spiraling a tad lower. And look, this has been spent several years in the making. Every day we find a new low, and I don't know that there's a bottom. But here to share some thoughts about the new article, a little bit about the convention, maybe apologize for not seeing me. I've asked our good friend Will Bunch to come share some thoughts. He's a national columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Hey, you know, like I was telling you before, somebody had tickets for a Cubs game at Wrigley Field. So that was my one afternoon of free time. So, maybe if you grow some ivy and, I don't know what to tell you.
But, you are forgiven.
Yeah, we'll get together one of these days.
You could have invited me to the Cubs game. The last time I went,
I was invited by somebody else. I was lucky. So not a lobbyist.
I got a bat of beer the last time I was there. So I was really thrilled with that.
Yeah. Well, you had lots of cool guests and people visiting you to keep you busy. So I'm surprised you even missed me.
No. Nobody rises to the level of Will Bunch. But I want to talk about this article, this piece you got about our news media, of which you're part of.
Yeah, I am. I mean, it's interesting. I'm kind of in a lucky place, right? Because I'm a national columnist. I get to cover national affairs. Maybe don't have quite as big a travel budget as some people, but got to go to both conventions in Milwaukee and Chicago and do all those things. But, you know, I think one thing that's a lot different about the way I'm not an access journalist. You know, I'm not based in New York. I'm not based in DC. You know, if I need to talk to somebody for what I'm writing, I try and track down the right person wherever they are in the country. But, you know, I'm not part of that, you know, cocktail culture. I don't go to those kinds of parties. I think that can help give you a clear perspective on things. You know, when I read the New York Times, I'm not reading like what my buddies wrote. I'm reading it the same way you and people listening to the show read it with some of the same critical eye. And recently I've been disappointed in many of the same ways that you and a lot of the other people listening to the show have been disappointed in the New York Times or the Washington Post or CNN or some of the other media that's out there. And so, you know, I really thought that the 2024 election was going to be different. And I mean, it's only been different in the sense that, like I said, it's been probably worse in terms of, you know, horse race journalism, both sides.
Oh, silly man. I mean, look, we know what the goal is. The goal is not informing a populace. The goal is not presenting the news as it is, so that critical thinking citizens can make choices. No, it's about getting people the eyeballs on pages and profits in pockets. That's more about what our media structure is about now than an informed populace.
Yeah, I mean it's the Politico format, right? You know that we're a 24-hour operation and. You know, we don't write daily stories, we write hourly stories because, you know, every little incremental development is going to be a story. But once you get into that mindset, you start focusing on, you know, responding to some poll, you know, Trump posted something stupid, what does the Harris campaign have to say about it? You know, those little hourly things that happen during a campaign. And, you never take a step back to say, you know, the healthcare situation in this country is a disaster. You know, we've got medical bankruptcies that bankruptcies that no other country in the world has. What are these people going to do about it? You know, nobody's, you know, I've seen almost no articles about what either candidate would do about, I mean, we know Trump wouldn't do anything, but, you know, or what the Harris campaign would do about healthcare. And that's just one issue. You know?
No, I'm right there with you, but you know, that's actual work.
you've got to take some time. It takes you a couple days, right, to research something like that. And, you know, then you're not filing, you're not, you know, I mean, editors, and this is true, I think, through most of journalism, including in a paper like The Inquirer, is, you know, we pay a lot of money for these services like Chartbeat that, you know, measure the amount of clicks, the amount of page views, how engagement time, how long people are engaged. And you've got a new breed of editors who, I mean, it's kind of like baseball with you know, the money ball, right? You know, it's like sabermetrics of journalism, you know, it's like.
So what does that say about, us though? I mean, because ultimately, you know, what you're saying is the media is giving us what we want. Because clearly hot takes and the latest hot take and the latest hot take on the latest hot take is what we want. We don't want actual solutions to problems. We just want to complain about them.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I've been doing this for a long time. You know, I started working full time in the 1980s, which was just a very different environment. And, you know, I think a lot of the editors I worked for, it's like, you know, well, sure. You know, if there's a really juicy story that people are dying to read about, of course, we're going to cover that because we want to, you know, back then you're trying to sell newspapers on a newsstand, right, at the convenience store or whatever. But, you know, yeah, we'll cover those stories. But, you know, we're not just here to give people what they want. We're here to give them the information they need, you know. And so we're going to do a series on the six biggest issues in the race. And we're just going to do, you know, we'll get our graphics people to do a chart on where the candidates stand and whatnot. And the thing is, I think, you know, what allowed that kind of attitude to flourish back in the 1980s is that newspapers and other news organizations, local TV stations, you know, they were making money hand over fist, you know, because they had pretty much a monopoly on the flow of information and the ability to, you know, sell ads and that, you know, I mean, monopolies aren't great perhaps, but they did give us a lot of freedom as journalists in terms of not having the financial pressures of today. Because today it's like, if you're not producing what people want to read, you're going to go out of business, you know, or we're going to have layoffs, you know, we're going to have, you know, it's a sad situation. I mean, it's a sad situation. I don't think it necessitates the kind of bad journalism we've seen in 2024, but it is a tough situation.
But ultimately, it's the garbage in, garbage out theory. I mean, we want garbage, we get garbage. But, you know, this idea that, and I was just reading an article over at the Times, not an article, an op-ed by this National Review guy who I'm not a huge fan of Rich Lowry, but this idea that, and I talked about this the other day, this idea that Trump can win on character. And it just blew my mind.
Well, if you read the piece, it's like he can win on character, not his own character, which he doesn't even really talk about, because what could he say, you know, positively about Trump's character? But it's like, no, he can win by sliming Kamala Harris's character.
Yeah.
Which is like, first of all, he's already doing that, as far as I can tell. But, you know, second of all, is that really worthy of an op-ed in the New York Times? I mean,
no, but the other part of this is, and as you point out in your article, you know, immediately when she announced that Tim Walz was going to be her running mate, immediately you saw all of these allegations popping out. He's a valor thief, and you know, he claimed he was, you know, honored by the Chamber of Commerce, but it was really, you know, some junior thing.
It was
thing.
Really the junior Chamber of Commerce. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, we've all seen or covered or followed actual stolen valor cases, right? And when that happens, the guy's out there making wild claims about, you know, he was in battle or he won this, you know, his resume says that he won some medal when actually he doesn't win it or whatever. And, you know, in the case of Tim Walz, you know, they're talking about one or two interviews in which he spoke in kind of a vague way, or, you know, as many of us do, like as I'm probably doing right now in this interview, you know, he said something in a confusing way that didn't sound quite right. And he's, I mean, you know, he, there's no indication that he has ever gone out of his way to misrepresent who he is or what he is. I mean, people are, you know, going so deep into his background that they're finding the littlest mistake, like, and basically, you know, it's the backup a theory, you know. Conservatives are terrified of Tim Walz. He's their worst nightmare, right? He's a guy.
But he's normal.
He's a guy from the heartland. He's a guy, he's a union member, you know. I mean, he can really help the Democrats reconnect with a lot of that type of voter that they've lost over the last 30 or 40 years. And the Republicans are terrified of that. And the only way they think they can counter that is by saying, well, this guy is too good to be true, you know, that he's not really who he says he is. You know, it's not like they're out there saying we disagree with him or anything. It's like they know that he's a good candidate. So it's like they're trying to find ways to tell people he's not who he is. And they know, you know, getting back to what we're talking about, the media, I mean, they know that the media will play along with a lot of this stuff.
They know that they'll report it. Look, you know, we've seen this time and time again. You get one of these little kernels of one of these conspiracy things, and it's on Fox News. It gets eventually in the New York Times. It becomes a story, and then they go, oh, there was nothing true about that. And then the retraction is maybe, you know, buried in a, you know, where the obituaries used to be.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they know how the whole ecosystem works, you know, that there's these bottom feeder right-wing sites, you know, and then there's, you know, certain political journalists just eager to get retweets on X or Twitter or whatever we're calling it today. And, you know, and they know there's outlets like Fox News and like the New York Post, which, you know, I don't know how much money they lose, but I mean, you know, the New York Post and their headlines are plastered. Anytime I walk into Wawa or any kind of convenience store, the first thing that hits you in the eye is the New York Post, you know, and people see these ridiculous headlines, half of which aren't true, you know. But then, you know, then it's like the New York Times and the Washington Post. It's like, well, everybody's talking about this, so we have to address this in some way, you know. So they'll address it in their backhanded way. It's like Republicans are trying to make an issue out of Tim Walz's background, you know, and it's the Streisand effect, right? They're by trying to knock down the story, they're actually amplifying it.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, it's just, I mean, the thing with the media, it's not any one thing. It's like five or six different type things that they're doing that are all not serving the public well.
No, and I've often said they've got rabbit ears, you know, the real, you know, baseball term, since you went to the Cubs game, you know, because the right knows how to yell at the ref. You're not covering us fairly. You're not giving us time, so that they get hyper aware, and then they go beyond actually being fair with this whole both sidesism thing they do, and then they end up basically being on their side on reporting all the garbage that goes on, and then normalizing how bad. I mean, the thing that gets me is every article doesn't start off with, you know, Trump was a horrible failure as a president, indicted, you know, convicted of 34 felonies.
Yeah, you mean, I was gonna say Donald Trump, a convicted felon, said yesterday, you know, I mean, that they all should, you're right, they all should begin like that. You know, I just want to say about your point about working the refs, I mean, it's so true. And to me, I mean, my personal insights on how they get away with that or why it works is, you know, I mean, look, different occupations attract different personality types, right? And it's not surprising that some of the qualities that make a person more liberal, you know, questioning authority and wanting accountability and those sorts of things, you know, some of the qualities that would cause people to maybe vote Democratic are qualities that make people want to go into journalism, right? And so, you know, people say, and it's true, that, you know, in newsrooms, you know, if you find out who people voted for, probably a lot more of them voted for a Democrat than for a Republican. There's not a lot of conservatives in newsrooms. But you know what? There's there's also a certain amount of guilt about that, right? It's like, well, we don't want, you know, our whole mantra is that we're, you know, not biased. And because we kind of are sort of liberal, although, you know, some of the elite Washington journalists who make six or seven figures probably aren't that liberal anymore. But, you know, we don't want people to think that. And so we're going to bend over backwards to be, you know, and funny, the counter to that is, you know, they also like go way out of their way to disavow the far left, because that would, there's no way they want to be associated with that. But they'll bend over backwards to accommodate Republicans and the right, because they feel that shows the world that they're not biased. And that's such, it's hard to explain if you're not a journalist, but that, you know, being able to say that you're not biased or that you're fair, and those two things aren't exactly the same, by the way, but, you know, being able to say that you're not biased is such an important value to journalists that it, you know, it, what it ends up doing, though, is it ends up creating journalism that creates a warped picture of reality. And how is that serving the public?
Right? No, absolutely. And look, as a labor guy, I look at the labor issue. And this is when Biden was in the election. There is no way that you can put Joe Biden and Donald Trump in the same sentence when you're talking about making lives of workers better and pushing labor policy. You know, Donald Trump was terrible for organized labor, terrible for working people. His tax policies were horrible, but they normalize how bad he was by comparing him to Biden. And there's no comparison whatsoever on any planet in any way, shape, or form, but it's that kind of both sides-ism journalism that's gotten us, I think, into the mess that we've got when we really need the information of just how bad Donald Trump was.
Yeah, and especially for working people, and especially, you know, he was so bad on unions, and a lot of it's the kind of stuff that just doesn't get a lot of coverage, you know, things he did at the NLRB or whatever, you know, it's the little things that always were pro business and always were anti-labor, you know,
things maybe people should know.
Yeah, absolutely. And, instead it's like, well, we went out to this blue collar diner in Ohio and talked to a bunch of guys and they still love Trump. And, you know, it's part of it's cultural stuff, but, you know, part of it is probably because even those union guys, you know, that's probably not just the media's fault. It's probably the union's fault too. But some of those guys just don't know economically how they're being screwed by this whole setup. You know?
Last question I got for you. Obviously you went to both conventions. You experienced both of them. Thoughts? Any gut reactions? Compare, contrast? Any of that?
It was a weird experience going to both conventions because usually in a normal year, and there's been a couple of years I've gone to both conventions, but usually one party knows it kind of has the upper hand, and one party kind of knows it's the underdog, and you get that kind of vibe from whatever. What was weird about 2024 was when I went to Milwaukee, the Republicans and frankly most of the world thought they were going to win when they were running against Biden, right? You know, and you had that confidence, you know, and that doesn't mean the vibe was the same. I mean the vibe very much there was around the cult of Donald Trump, you know, and remember in the week after this assassination attempt, it was kind of the deification of Donald Trump, you know, that God had saved him from this bullet, and you know, there were no interesting speeches because, I mean, Trump's wasn't interesting, but I mean, there were no other interesting speeches because all they were just, you know, about how Donald Trump is the kindest, warmest, bravest, you know, most wonderful man I've ever met in my life, you know, and it was kind of weird, you know, I mean.
No, O'Brien from the Teamsters was there.
Yeah, that was a weird. That was a weird note. It was kind of off key, but yeah. So that was Milwaukee. But then, you know, by the time you got to Chicago, everything had changed. You know, I mean, there was this. You know, I think, you know, I would love to do this, but I for a bunch of reasons I probably won't. But someone's going to write a book about the 2024 election, and the title, I guarantee you, is going to be Vibe Shift, because that's the one word, that's the one new, you know, neologism that describes 2024 was this incredible vibe shift, right? And, you know, and people, you know, and the word, you know, it was funny. I mean, the word joy has been kind of overused at this point. And I was actually went to Chicago thinking, well, how can I avoid, you know, writing the word joy 100 times? Same. And then when I got there, I found out it wasn't really joy. It was ecstasy. It was like, you know, I wrote a column, but it was like a rave. It was like, it should have been held in an abandoned warehouse on the West Side, you know, and at 2 a.m. I mean, people were on this, you know, legal high, yeah. You know, I mean, and they were dancing in the aisles, you know, I mean, this is, I think, the 8th convention I've been to, in person, and nothing else was like this, you know, I mean, it was really, I mean, it, and everybody who was there just, you know, has this, oh my God, I just lived through such a, you know, I lived through a memorable moment that this is really history, that something's happening here, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Like I said, the same thing. You know, the energy was electric, and you know, clearly people are going to hopefully take that energy out into knocking on doors and making phone calls. And look, there's a reason to. There was some fear that, you know, Biden was going to get beaten in November. Now you've got this rejuvenated hope.
Yeah, but you know, it was interesting though, because it's just it was that, but also it seems to have created a whole new attitude. You know, a whole new. I mean, one thing. You know, I mean. And this might sound like a weird thing to say, because I know the Democrats have won elections, Clinton, Obama, whatever. But, you know, for so much of the last 40 years since Reagan, I mean, the Democrats have been governed by fear, you know, you know, can we say this, blah, 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 you know, and that fear was gone in Chicago. I mean, it really wasn't there. It was really a fearless political party that, you know,
and, they want to win. And not,
yeah.
Ultimately,
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, ultimately, that's what it comes down to. They want to win. And when Kamala Harris chose Tim Walz, that was the message to me to go, she wants to win. And I know everyone wants to win, but no, that really was a great pick. But Will, as always, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Great article. Hope folks take a look at the work. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at Will Bunch's stuff. But Will, I appreciate it, man.
Hey, Rick, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Good talking to you.
Again, we'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at the latest critique of our media structure. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1907. That was the day that became known for the Quebec Bridge disaster in Canada. Workers were building a cantilever bridge over the St. Lawrence River. This was not an easy task. The river was 2 miles wide at its narrowest point. The river was deep, moved quickly, and was icy in the winter. But in the late 1880s, businessmen in Quebec who wanted to keep up trade with Montreal decided the river had to be spanned. The project did not begin for more than a decade due to a lack of funds. Finally, the Canadian government supported the project to improve the nation's railway infrastructure. Theodore Cooper, a respected American bridge designer, was signed on for the project. Despite concerns about the bridge's design, he never visited the site due to illness. 86 men were working on the project that fateful day. Their workday was drawing to a close when the bridge suddenly collapsed. 75 men plunged to their deaths. Some of their bodies were never found. The bridge collapsed because of design flaws. The official report of the disaster noted that the loss of life, quote, might have been prevented by the exercise of better judgment on the part of those in responsible charge of the work for the Quebec Bridge and Railway Company and the Phoenix Bridge Company. Unfortunately, it was not the last tragedy trying to cross the St. Lawrence. After the bridge collapsed, the Canadian government took over the project. A partial collapse on that effort killed 13 more workers in 1916. The bridge finally opened in 1917. Its completion came at a high price, costing $22 million and 86 lives.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So, real quick email. Steve sent me an email saying, on your 8/27/24 show, you said character matters. Yes, He writes, Trump is lacking character, and 100% of that lack is based on his being a Machiavellian, sadistic sociopath. Steve writes, these are probably the most dangerous people on the planet that the planet has ever seen. Both Mussolini and Hitler had this. They have no conscience, and therefore they have no guardrails preventing them from doing evil. They manipulate people like pawns on a chessboard. They exist entirely outside of our social contract and its virtues. And this is true. Look, I mean, and I think that's part of the reason that people are drawn to them, because they're like, you know, I don't care about anybody. I don't care about you or anybody else. But more importantly, I really don't like those people. And that, I think, has caught a lot of people's attention. The cult is that kind of anger. And look, the anger is real out there. What we were told as kids, that, you know, you work hard, play by the rules, you're going to get ahead. A lot of people struggling. And anger sells. Going to finish off with Dave McCormick, Senate candidate here in my state of Pennsylvania. Evidently, someone in the social media department's going to get fired, because they reposted a news clip of a Mississippi television station that reported on a shooting that allegedly involved an MS-13 gang member who, according to the reports, shot multiple people after coming here illegally. And so they put this out, you know, saying MS-13 gang members are terrorizing Philadelphians because of Harris and Casey's radical open border policies. Now, they took it down a couple minutes later because, well, someone pointed out those little letters after the city, those are called states. Philadelphia, Mississippi, kind of far from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And look, the Bob Casey campaign did not waste a minute going after them. Casey's communications guy said, since David McCormick lives in Connecticut, it's not surprising he can't tell you the difference between Pennsylvania and Mississippi. He writes, we can help, Dave. Pennsylvania is the state that's going to reject you in November. I do find it interesting. Now, again, they got rid of the social media post because, oops, that's how it goes. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, make sure you get the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Also, freespeech.org for the video. You got questions, comments, something I said made you think, made you angry, made you mad, happy, sad. I want to hear about it. Rick@therickSmithShow.com. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick at Rick@therickSmithShow.com.